This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and today we're going to talk about a piece of history some of you may not have heard about, some of you may have, but it is intriguing nevertheless. It takes place in World War II, now some 70 years ago, and it's about an internment camp that was there for Germans and Japanese Americans south of Bismarck in a place called Fort Lincoln. You've probably heard of that name. Approximately 120,000 Japanese Americans were illegally incarcerated during the war at several camps around the United States. Thousands of them ended up at Fort Lincoln. Their only crime was looking like the enemy, and the majority of them were American citizens. And that's what we're going to talk about for the next several minutes with Kayoko Norma Nozaki, who is a professor emeritus of intercultural studies at the Kyoto Sangyo University in Japan, of course. And also Dennis Newman joins us because he is the public information officer for United Tribes Community College. And that's what Fort Lincoln became, well, I guess about 50 years ago.
Yep.
Dennis, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug. Thanks for having us.
And Kyoko, thank you very
much. Thank you.
You have a personal story. Your father was interned at Fort Lincoln.
That's correct.
How old was he when he went there?
He was born in 1909, so he was 32 then.
And he was one of the internees that were actually transferred from another camp, right?
Yes, he was. He got picked up by FBI at Tula Lake Camp, and was sent to Bismarck, leaving us, his wife. My mother was 25, and my brother was 5, and I was 2 then.
So very young, and you were left alone at Tula Lake yet?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
So what was your father's story? Tell us his story. How did he end up in Tula Lake to begin with, and how did he why was he picked up?
Well, we suppose right now that there were questions were given to all the internees over age 17, and the questions in issue, particularly in that questionnaire, was question 27 and 28, which is commonly known as loyalty questions, and they ask about whether you're willing to serve in American Army or do you forswear allegiance to Japanese government and things like that. And so he answered that the first question, no, because of the family obligation. The second question, he had a conditional no, and he actually stated that this does not mean he's disloyal to American government. And all along, I sort of half believed what he said. But when I was writing a book, Internment and Camp, and I got files from a National Archives, and in the documents that I received, I clearly saw the proof of what he wrote at the time. So, you know, I was very shock at what I saw.
Well, your father was born in California in 1909, so he was a U.S. citizen by any definition that I know.
Yes, he was.
Mm-hmm. Now, he was also labeled a recalcitrant, however, because mm-hmm. that's what these people who were transferred from Tule Lake were known as when mm-hmm. they came to Fort Lincoln in Bismarck, and that meant that they were at least in the environment of the camps considered to be a little tougher or a little...
Well, actually, are you talking about the Tula Lake or are you talking about
I'm talking about Fort Lincoln.
Fort Lincoln, he thought that it was very – actually, he treated better than when he was in Tula Lake. And, of course, it was because it was operated under different departments. And then all the people in the Fort Lincoln were professionals. I mean, they know what they're doing. And whereas the WRA or sort of, the lay – persons, it wasn't really systematically done to start with. But so he said that he was treated better over there.
Dennis, there were two agencies of the federal government who were dealing with this. Lay that out for us.
Yeah, the internment is a period of time leading up to World War II, the time period we're speaking about here, and through the Second World War, where the federal government was challenged with this question of what they were going to do with security. Supposedly, secure the nation's borders and secure the people coming and going. We're a free nation. We can have people come and go as we please. And there were two main agencies dealing with the internment. The one that Fort Lincoln is associated with is what is known as the Alien Enemy Control Program, or the AECP. And that was run by the U.S. Justice Department. It was under the Justice Department's supervision. The Immigration and Naturalization Service of the United States ran it. There were Border Patrol guards from this region of the country and from other parts of the country who were staffed there at Fort Lincoln. And there were about eight camps in that Justice Department grouping. And then the other major one, the one that Kyoko is talking about here, that swept up Japanese Americans, Japanese nationals, but a larger percentage of U.S. citizens of Japanese ancestry, was the War Relocation Authority Program, run by the military, by the War Department. And that primarily was prompted by these war hysteria fears throughout the country, but primarily on the West Coast. And it they hastily created a system that allowed for the collection and assembly of men, women, and children, children as young as Kyoko at age five, and her father in his 30s, and her mother and brother, and many other families, as many as 120,000 or so, that were caused to leave their possessions, to leave their homes, to leave their livelihoods, and to be put into these assembly centers and these relocation centers in places away from the western seaboard of the country. There was the government created an exclusion line.
And the idea would be that they were potentially enemy combatants or spies or something
like
that?
Yeah, in that day they called it the fifth column.
Mm-hmm. And spy, mostly, I think.
Yep, and to the credit of all Japanese Americans and everybody, there was never, has never been any evidence whatsoever that there was this sort of espionage or behind-the-scenes activity going on at all. But the climate in the United States was such politically and in the media, the press of the day, and the cry of politicians all across made it such that at and around the time of Pearl Harbor and in the weeks following Pearl Harbor, the government had to do something just because of this outcry to do something about the Japanese who were in the United States. It's been pretty much documented all the way down the line that there was a failure to lead right from the president on down.
The president signs an executive order, basically mandating this.
He does. He signs several executive orders, and there are several things passed by the Congress of the United States and then amplified by the War Department and amplified by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a hysteria thing that many of these people and their families are caught up in.
Right.
So we get to caught up with some euphemisms, too, like the word internment camp. These people were prisoners.
They were. They certainly were. There is the distinction that they are all non-combatants, and that's a distinction that a lot of people who are unfamiliar with the story don't usually draw. I mean, they weren't so-called prisoner of war camps, but they were camps that had 10-foot-high cyclone fences topped with barbed wire, such as what Fort Lincoln had. There were guards with Thompson submachine guns. There were dogs. There were rifles and other forms of confinement in all of the camps. And Fort Lincoln was set up that way, a 500 by 1,300 area of what was formerly a frontier military post of the day, was cordoned off, and there were large brick buildings in there that are still standing today that we still use at United Tribes that were barracks. There were internal systems in the camps, and they were confined. They lost their freedom, and they lost their ability to go about like citizens of the United States have.
Mm-hmm. Kiyoko, you said your father thought that the Fort Lincoln environment was a better one than Tule Lake. Mm-hmm. How did he describe living there?
Well, actually, he was, in terms of food, you know, it was better. And of course, it was the one thing I remember he said it was that he was given allowance of 10 cents a day. And he used to, it was his daily habit to go to cafeteria to have two coffee breaks a day, because there's cup of coffee was 3 cents and donuts were 2 cents. Mm. So he allowed himself two coffee breaks a day. So that part he enjoyed, he said. But I think I must say that it was one, of course, the thing is, it was the freedom that he missed.
Sure.
You know, and that was the thing that he was against. And that was why I think he was angry at American government for, you know, denying this, because he was really all American. In fact, he was so American that he was even considered as Innu, as a, you know, spy. He was spying for American government by a pro-Japanese people, that yeah. American he was. And so the more he loved America, you know, the country and everything, culture, everything, I think he was more disappointed in the way, by the way, the American government treated him.
How long were you separated from your father?
10 months.
And
this was the year the war actually ended. He got picked up in February 11, 1945, which showed in the archives, documents I got from National Archives. And then we were joined on board SS Gordon on December 29th, left there for Japan.
Okay. So you actually left the country after the war for Japan.
Right, uh-huh.
And why?
Because that was my father's decision.
Sure.
He didn't want to stay in the country where he was denied.
Yeah, I hear you. What was your father's occupation before he was picked up and put in the camp with you?
He owned a strawberry farms. That is why I thought it was irony that I happened to pick up the box of strawberry that was actually the product of Wassonville.
Well, let's talk about his business. Did it just go away? It was completely gone because of this?
Well, I remember what he told me, that he used to spend so much time investing all the labor. And it's like one time he said he had to spend 20 hours working in the field at the harvest time. And he had to put the flashlight on top of his head to harvest. And that much he put into the strawberry, and then he had to abandon everything in April when he had to relocate. And so when we were only allowed to take what we could carry, so that's why he bought these two army trunks. And then by the time we left home, we had to abandon the strawberry, so the house was filled with the delicious smell of strawberries.
But you're returning to Japan, or he's going to Japan with his family at a mm-hmm. time when Japan is in a lot of
yes,
a country
that's
devastated. Been defeated and devastated.
Right, right.
So what kind of life did he build for his family there?
Well, actually, I do remember the day we arrived. That was like January 6th or 7th of 1946. And I remember our train go past the Hiroshima and devastating scene we saw. But after that, he was ironically recruited by American Occupation Army and appointed as an interpreter, because everything must be done through this interpreter. And thereon, that led him into a movies company's job. And he ended up become quite an international successful businessman. I ended up meeting Marilyn Monroe while in Japan.
Well, this is an amazing story you have here, and a fair amount of irony that we've just touched
yes.
on. We'll get back to this. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Kiyoko Norma Nozaki, a retired professor from Japan who's interested in intercultural studies and the role that Fort Lincoln played in her father's life and in her own life, and Dennis Newman, Public Information Director for United Tribes Community College. More in a moment.
So Support for this program is provided by the North Dakota Education Association, an organization of 8,000 school employees working to ensure great public schools for every child.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with part one of The Dust Bowl. Tonight's installment is called The Great Plow Out. Then at 9 Central, Frontline presents The Retirement Gamble. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Dennis Newman, Public Information Director for United Tribes Community College, and Kyoko Norma Nozaki, visiting professor, retired professor from Kyoto Sanyo University in Japan. And we're talking about Fort Lincoln, which was, during World War II, an internment camp for Japanese Americans and German Americans as well. Dennis, these two groups were in the same place at the same time. How did they get along?
Well, I think it was an amicable arrangement, if you could call it that.
They were both in the same circumstance.
They were separated in ways from what I understand from the stories that I've heard and read. The Germans were actually classed in a different way than the Japanese internees. That is, they were seen differently by the government because they were nationals. That is, some of them were
– like sailors that they'd picked
that's
up?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Merchant mariners, seamen on Standard Oil tankers. That was one of the first groups that arrived there in 1941. And other sailors from Germany that actually were loyal to the Nazi regime. And so they were a different mix of people and individuals, and their legal status was different than those who were internees who were renunciants who had come from Tule Lake. The materials and the record shows that that the camp did segregate. They weren't kept in the same barracks buildings. They ate in different locations. But oddly enough, you can't put down culture. There is a cultural mix that takes place in some of the stories I've heard. People picked up stuff from the other culture. A Japanese internee who lives in Sacramento, her father just loved Wagner after his time of mixing with the music that he heard there played by the Germans in the camp.
How does UTTC deal with this history? I mean, there have been people who have come back to see it, I assume.
Oh, yes. Yeah. In fact, this is one of the important things that United Tribes does is that since the days of probably the 80s or even the late 70s, United Tribes President David Gipp has been a welcoming influence to all internees, and he's met literally dozens of internees, as we have. And in the last 10 years, we've had a couple of different conferences where we have hosted former internees and their families to explore this. And the reason for that is because there is a parallel track of experience between these ethnic groups, going way back to the government's handling of American Indian people all across the continent since first contact. There is a pattern, and it's not hard to distinguish. Many scholars have worked on this and have shown the patterns of exclusion, of confinement, of oppression that have been visited upon American Indians. And so there's an affinity here. And that affinity has worked its way out all across the time. And there's been some significant scholarship on it. But at United Tribes, it's a welcoming environment that looks at this as an important subject for all people to learn about. For everybody in North Dakota, it is a contemporary subject that needs to be dealt with about how certain peoples in society are dealt with when hysteria runs amok in the country.
Kyoko, what was your feeling when you first saw the place where your father was
kept? I became very emotional, of course, and President Gipp at the time I visited welcomed me and then gave me the gift of a Native American kilt, which has been on my bed ever since, and I publicize this all the time. And so for me, it was very emotional. And at the same time that I I learned that I have to really carry on this legacy and tell all the people who are not aware of what happened in the history. People need to know this. I come back very often, but usually on the West Coast, the people over there are very familiar with what happened. But when it comes to this inland people, I think it's difficult to know. A lot of people are not even aware of what happened. So it's important to listen to the voices of ordinary people.
Is there much interest in this subject in Japan?
In Japan, it's growing. I think thanks to my colleagues and younger graduate students, who there is a growing interest in this field. And one thing I'd like to say is that I think it's very interesting that where Japanese American and Japanese were interned, now it's occupied by Native American people who's, the long history of tragedies, resettlements and reincarceration were kind of overlapped. I think their fate was sort of, united there.
Well, what drew you to this academic subject yourself? Is it your life experience brought you to this?
Well, it was like when I was an undergraduate student. Well, actually, I spent my senior year in James Lake High School, and all my Japanese-American sansei cousins refused to call me my middle name, Norma. They call me Norma, but they refused to call me my first name, Kyoko. And I couldn't understand why. And I realized then later that there is a racism existed then. And then, of course, we were in the camps. So they didn't want to have anything to do with Japanese. And then the other thing is I went back to whenever I was when Japanese American get together, they're always talking about camps. I didn't know what they're talking about. They're talking about the internment camps. And so I went back and I asked my parents, were we ever in the camps? And he said, of course we were. And I asked my father, well, you never told me because you never ask. So that's got into my study of researching Japanese American. But for a long time, I didn't know that my father was connected with Bismarck.
Well, you were so young. Yes.
Well, yeah.
Dennis, there's a special event tomorrow at NDSU.
There is. Kyoko is the special speaker tomorrow at North Dakota State University at the Memorial Union in the Century Theater at noon. She'll give a talk, and I'll show a few pictures of the camp of Fort Lincoln. We'll talk about this experience and delve into it a little bit more. The Division of Equity, Diversity, and Global Outreach there at NDSU is sponsoring it, and we're grateful that they're having us tomorrow, and it's open to the public.
Just a bit of a note of information here. This issue was in Canada, too. There were camps in Canada, and both Canada and the United States actually adopted sort of, if you will, public apologies regarding this. In 1988, there was the Civil Liberties Act in the United States, which offered redress and reparations to those people who weren't interned. It included a $20,000 reparation, not that that would replace a business, and a signed apology to those survivors. So there was something done. Did it mean anything to you?
Yes, I actually visited that campsite in Canada. I was given a government grant, and so I visited there. And actually, their situation is even harsher than Americans because they don't have a constitution. In Japan, although the redress and reparation took place almost the same time and the amount is the same, I feel that we were actually luckier to be American than Canadian, I felt.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today. That's Kyoko Norma Nozaki, retired professor in the Department of Intercultural Studies at Kyoto Sangyo University. And Dennis Newman, public information director for the United Tribes Community College. Thanks for joining us today and shedding some light on this very important history.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And now the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A new animal cruelty law is closer to reality. The state Senate passed the bill, which establishes North Dakota's first felony penalties for animal cruelty. New Rockford Democratic Senator Joan Heckeman says the bill strikes a balance.
And that balance is among the priorities of protecting our animals, protecting agriculture and our animal stewards, providing appropriate clarity as well as flexibility for law enforcement, prosecutors, veterinarians, shelters, and others who help animals in trouble.
But Williston Republican Senator Stan Leeson says the bill is, as he put it, way over the top.
And I know you've tried to put some lipstick on it, But when you do that to a pig, he's still a pig. And I'm going to vote no.
The measure passed the Senate 43-3, and now the House will vote on it. There's been some talk that the legislature may work this Saturday in an effort to finish its work on the 2013 session. House Majority Leader Al Carlson told his House caucus that whether lawmakers will work on Saturday depends on what happens over the next few days.
But if we can't finish on Saturday night, then I don't think, in my opinion, we shouldn't be working Sunday. Then we'll come back and work, and hopefully the worst that we'd have is that Monday or Tuesday night we'd wrap up. But there's a lot of ground to cover.
Major issues still unresolved include higher education, K-12 education, infrastructure spending, and tax relief. And because of the impending flood, Fargo has decided to delay spring cleanup week that takes place the first week of May. City Commissioner Mike Williams says that's apparently ticked off some people, like the pickers who check out the piles of junk on the boulevards before it gets hauled away to the landfill. He says the city's been getting some calls on it.
The most annoyed people about moving it are people that are not live around here, but they take a week off so they can make some extra cash on cleanup week. So we'll just have to tell them to postpone their vacation till September.
Cleanup week has been moved to the last week of September. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's time now for an update in our series, New American Stories, produced by Erica Lorenzen for Prairie Public. This focuses on the immigrant experience, and today's topic is misunderstandings.
Dirk Arkart is from Germany. He says just basic knowledge of English sometimes isn't enough.
The most difficult thing for a foreigner is to understand jokes. If you understand irony or humor in a foreign language, you're an advanced speaker. So for me, it's sometimes very hard to understand jokes, but it's even harder to make jokes, so I always fail in that part too.
When Kina Wong arrived in America from Cambodia, she knew no English. She says she had a hard time understanding things that came easy to her American peers.
When I was young, I never trained to drink like milk and stuff like that. We didn't have that kind of nutritious stuff. So when I would go to school, they gave me milk. I didn't know how to drink those stuff. And my teacher was telling me I was young, you know, and I didn't know how to speak English either. So I wouldn't know. So I just take the milk and put all pile in my locker. I keep save the milk and then bring it to the locker and put it in my locker. And they was wondering what happened to the milk. I mean, they walk by my locker, it always smells stink. So when they open the locker, there's all this milk sitting in the locker. So it's all spoiled milk.
Shamsi Shakuna is from Somalia. She says immigrants are not always the ones misreading the situation.
My mom went to a retail store, and the way that she was dressed, this other lady who works at the store automatically presumed that she would be needing to go to the clearance section. So she comes to my mom and she looks at her and says, oh, these things over here, you need to be on that. The clearance section is on that side. And my mom is like, you know, I can't afford anything else in this store. Like, why are you automatically assuming that I should be going to the clearance section? But she doesn't speak English, so she couldn't really defend herself or say anything. So she just kept shopping. And just to show that lady, like, yep, you don't need to judge people, you know, at first look, she went and just got something expensive and bought it and left. But if I was her, I probably wouldn't even buy anything. And I would give her a piece of my mind about it. Another story personally about me is I remember I was in middle school working at McDonald's. And this lady came up to me. She was probably around 35, 40-ish, and her mother was with her, who was, you know, a little elderly mother, elderly lady. And she gave me, her bill was like 13-something, and she gave me a $20 bill. Now, looking at it, to me, that $20 looked like a $10. So I was just correcting. I was like, oh, ma'am, you owe $3 more. And some change. And she looked at me and she said, look at it, it's a $20 bill. Don't you understand anything? You don't belong here. You need to go back to your country. And she just kept saying it loud so everyone in the store can in the restaurant can hear her. And I was young that time, and I was just like almost going to be crying, or I can't even say anything to her because I need to be professional and be working still and just take what she just said. But I know if it was another chick, another girl who was standing next to me, and she being a white girl, I am pretty sure she would never say anything like that to her. But just by looking at me, she automatically assumed, you're African, you need to go back where you came from, you're dumb. And it was just an honest mistake that anybody can make.
Eric Basimwa was from the Congo. He believes African immigrants struggle with understanding something very important, following the law.
Which some tradition, you might think you're doing a tradition, but you're breaking the law or rules here. And there's no excuse. Like me, I've been here long enough. I know reading, writing. I don't have any excuse to say I didn't know. Where the refugee who come, they break the law. They don't know. They don't speak English. Let's say I know the big problem was like people come, buy a car, start driving. Because Africa, some country, they don't care you have driving license or insurance. When police stop you, you already broke the laws. You think you're still in Africa. Or maybe the apartments. Some country, people talk loud, shouting. So they were thinking, the neighbor can think maybe they're fighting. So the neighbor called police. Oh, this apartment, tell, they're fighting. So police will come and say, no, we're not fighting, we're just talking. So in the street, the same thing. Or the way they treat women is different. America is not the same way.
Standing out and being different in a new country can lead to unexpected hassles. Adjusting to life in the U.S. takes tenacity, even in a place which claims to celebrate difference. This is Erica Lawrenson for Prairie Public.
And next week, we'll hear a story about looking for a place of worship and hear about a Bhutanese wedding in Fargo. This series was made possible by the support of the Humanities Council and the FM Area Foundation. You can learn more at prairiepublic.org/newamericanstories. Ashley Thornburg joins me in a moment.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Hey, Peter Sagal here, and if you're not busy on May 2nd, I was hoping you'd like to come to the movies with me. Wait, don't tell me. We'll be broadcast live to movie screens all over the country. Come on, it'll be fun.
That's coming up May 2nd at the Grand Theater in Bismarck and Century 10 in Fargo at 7 p.m. More information at prairiepublic.org/radio.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and we're going to talk about cooking, but not just cooking. Launching a new business, this is not easy, so it helps to have friends with a little knowledge, and those friends might be SCORE. That's Service Corps of Retired Executives. They help a lot of people get their feet off the ground or their businesses off the ground, lends its expertise to startups to help them get going. And Ashley Thornburg, you found a company that's used those services, and they're paying it forward now.
Yeah, you can definitely say that. It's called Square One Kitchens, and this is my favorite way to describe it. It's a startup that's helping other startups start up. It's very meta.
What's a start in there?
It. It's part of this whole business incubation movement and something that's been growing mostly since the 1950s. It started in New York in the 1950s, but didn't really catch on until the 80s and 90s and is, you know, hitting the Midwest a little bit more now. Business incubation is a support process that really promotes growth and development by providing really targeted resources and services, ones that are very specific to the business that it's helping to grow. They help with business basics from everything like paperwork to getting loans to networking and even intellectual property management. Square One used SCORE's help to get going, and now it's helping other businesses grow. Shannon Malzahn is busy whisking up soy sauce, brown sugar, a healthy dose of Kentucky bourbon, and a few more secret ingredients.
Today I'm making the bourbon teriyaki wings.
She's the owner and events coordinator at Lush Lola's, a catering company that got its start serving the Minnesota Lakes area.
A lot of what we do, because we're Lush Lola's, is we cook with alcohol, and we're especially known for our beer-braised meats, but we've added services like hog roasts and shrimp boils and pitchfork fondue and things where we can, you know, inject a little fun into the atmosphere, both with our food but also our attitude about things.
Lush Lola's is expanding both its offerings and its coverage area, heading west. It's largely thanks to an incubator kitchen the first of its kind to hit North Dakota. Incubator kitchens are a cost-sharing approach to growing commercial food companies. Owning a fully licensed facility up to health code can be prohibitively expensive for startup companies, and even established companies only busy seasonally, like wedding and graduation season and the holidays. This kitchen is co-owned by Casey Steele and her husband Matt, who rent out kitchen space and equipment to bakeries, caterers, food instructors, and even the general public.
I rented a kitchen when I started my baking business, Love in the Oven Bakery. And so over the years, I started having people ask me, you know, where else can I rent a kitchen? Can I rent the same kitchen you are? Lots of different interest in starting up their own business. And the time came for me to move on beyond this the kitchen I was renting. And I had heard about these places. They're popular in the West and this, you know, East Coast. And we decided that Fargo was ready for it, and we could, you know, offer a resource that's not here already.
Food professionals have long been renting kitchen space, but an incubator kitchen is more than a rental kitchen. Incubators help out with everything from marketing to mentoring.
We worked very closely with the health department through the whole construction process and the, you know, even the conceptual process. I was working with our health inspector, you know, making sure that we did everything right and that everything met the, you know, met code. And I'm also you know, making sure that all these different people who use the kitchen are following all the guidelines and making sure they don't get in trouble. Because it is a learning process. It's not, most of it's common sense, but there are little things where you're like, oh, you know, I probably wouldn't have thought of that. And I just, you know, I'm here to make sure everyone follows the rules and, you know, knows how it all works so that they don't get in trouble with their business.
Casey promotes her clients on her Facebook page and more. A novel concept, considering it's kind of like Target promoting Walmart in its ads.
I'm a baker, so all these other people are technically competitors, but we each offer our own individual things that make our businesses unique. And I think it creates a sense of community versus this competition where, you know, people are telling me, like, you're just harvesting competition by letting bakers come in. And I think it's cool to, this area has lots of room for expansion in the food world, so I think it's all good, and everyone gets along really well, so you don't have any problems yet.
There are currently 6 bakery and catering clients sharing Square One's 3,200 square foot building. It's equipped with 2 commercial kitchens, event space, and food storage. These are invaluable for startups and companies that are expanding. Here's Lush Lola's Shannon Malzahn.
I was lucky enough to kind of have the inside track. I had some banker friends and some real estate friends that told me, you know, what was kind of going on in the area and said that I needed to call Casey up. And so I did, and I kind of stalked her for a couple months, wondering when the kitchen would be done because I was so excited and just thought it was such a great idea and really fit with where I saw my business going.
Square One is also home to a vigorous class schedule, with courses for anyone who is just beginning in the kitchen to those who just want to polish their skills.
From cooking to baking to, like, we have a truffle making class coming up.
Classes are mostly taught by executive chef Tim Rosendahl, whose resume reads like a list of ingredients.
I have been an executive chef at Walt Disney World for 12 years, and I worked all over Walt Disney World, as well as I developed the largest chef's training program in the country, corporate training program called the Disney Culinary Apprenticeship. I was the vice president of Red Lobster. I've owned a restaurant in Daytona Beach. I've owned a restaurant in Miami. I've worked at a steakhouse. I've been the consulting corporate chef to Dole Foods, the consulting corporate chef to Jennie-O Turkey Store. I'm currently a corporate chef to the Mexican Avocado Board. I'm the corporate chef to the largest garlic company in the world. I have been the corporate chef for Butterball Butter, not Butterball Turkeys, but Butterball Butter, the second largest butter company in America. And I still do consulting for Applebee's and TGI Fridays and Red Lobster and multiple restaurant chains.
There are a lot of reasons to lie about your age. Vanity, buying beer. But Tim, he did it to get a job. Yes, you heard correctly, to get a job.
When I started working in restaurants in Fargo, when I probably overstated my age when I was 14 years old and worked in restaurants and bars and clubs and Elks clubs and restaurants around town. So I've never done anything but food in my life.
He loves food. It drips out of him like he's a freshly squeezed orange. And he says this passion and awareness of food is spreading across the whole country.
When I do go to the supermarket and I'm buying foodstuffs for catered dinners or whatever I'm working on at the time, I find that if I wear a chef coat in there, I become the resident food wizard because everybody wants to ask questions about how do you cook asparagus? What do you do with artichokes? How do you make a stuffed artichoke? Can you put the eye round on the grill? Is that a piece, is that meat, piece of meat there? Can you grill it? Do you braise it? Is it slow cook? Is it fast cook? What do you do with this kind of garlic? What do you do? You know, it's just amazing. There's so many more ingredients available now, and that's seafood and meat and herbs and spices and greens. And the international aisle of the grocery store used to be taco shells and taco salsa and, you know, just a few things. And now it's getting pretty expansive. And so I think the food knowledge has grown because of the interest in food.
And it doesn't stop with cooks. The professional chefs at Square One cultivate each other just from sharing space. Here's Lush Lola's Shannon Malzahn.
A lot of us do weddings especially, so obviously as we're getting prepared for a wedding, there's a lot more of us around here, and we're, you know, furiously working and trying to get ready for a particular event. And so it's kind of fun to, you know, just have somebody to talk to and even, you know, share certain ideas about cooking methods or anything like that. It's a lot of fun.
Commercial operations do need to be properly licensed to use Square One, and Square One can help with that process. The kitchen is also available to rent to people who just like to can food or want to do their own graduation parties, rehearsal dinners, baby showers, things like that. As long as they're not selling their food, they don't need to be licensed. And I should mention, too, that this kitchen is located just off of University and First Avenue North in Fargo.
What if I want to learn about cooking from these folks?
They have quite a number of classes. One of them is this kind of culinary boot camp from things like soups, sauces, and dressings to just cooking methods. When do I saute? When do I braise meat? What is the best kind of cut to buy for this kind of meat? Just a lot of that basic know-how that's unfortunately not as basic as it used to be.
Yeah, I'd have to unlearn some things, I think, because teaching myself has been really catch-as-catch-can.
One class that I thought was really fun, too, is they have a Mother's Day brunch for dads.
Oh.
You know, people who might need a little bit more help.
Right. And lots of exotic stuff they make, too. Truffle making, cooking with brie.
A class dedicated to just garlic. I really love that idea.
Take me there.
And the Casey there, who you heard from, one of the co-owners there, she said that, in effect, how some of the classes work is the instructors actually rent the space and then are able to teach the course. And she said they're actually looking for people. They're getting a lot of interest in things like gluten-free cooking, vegan cooking, the kind of highly specialized cooking. And so if you know someone who might want to teach that class, you can certainly reach out to Square One.
Well, thanks. That was a real tasty feature. Appreciate it. Well, speaking of food, today we start a new feature. Here's Andrea Wencher-Collin with a serving of Vittles in the Vast Lane called A Taste of Home Serves Kindness and Hospitality.
There are many adjectives that describe the wide open spaces of North Dakota. Vast is one. The dictionary defines vast as immense, a very great area or extent, huge, and enormous. Vast is a good word. It is especially fitting when driving down the highway, as in vast lanes. North Dakota State magazine, North Dakota Horizons, is cruising through its fifth decade of existence, and we have decided to add to the pages of each issue a new food culture feature called Vittles in the Vast Lane. This is a nod to a colorful brochure that was published in 2000 by North Dakota Tourism. It highlighted the many special places to eat along the stretches of North Dakota's highways. You know what I mean. We all have our favorite spots along the vast lanes we travel that serve a special sandwich or cut of meat or pie or fountain drink that we can't find anywhere else. With the help of our readers, we will explore and celebrate these stops. Travel down North Dakota's vast lanes, and there are intersections and connections. This is true as well with the intersection of food along the vast lanes of our lives. What we eat, what we grow, why we eat what we eat, when we eat what we eat. old family traditions, new family traditions. They all connect and define who we are as individuals and who we are as North Dakotans. North Dakota's economy today is bringing people to our state who probably never in their wildest dreams thought they would live here. Do you ever wonder what kind of first impression we give these new residents? Are we welcoming? Are we hospitable? Is our food anything like what they are used to eating? Kathleen Wrigley shed some light on her experience in our spring issue. She moved to North Dakota 15 years ago as a bride. She and her husband, now Lieutenant Governor Drew Wrigley, had married in the Irish district of her hometown of Philadelphia 4 months earlier. Drew had been raised in Fargo, and they moved to Bismarck so she could take a new job. She only cried halfway from Philadelphia to North Dakota, she recalls. Then she began to consider it an adventure like none other in her life. It would be them against the world. Bismarck would have none of her friends or his friends. Everyone they would meet would be new friends to them both. So with her husband already working, Kathleen set about getting acquainted with the town and looking for a job. One of her first stops was the shopping mall, where she was drawn to the pretzel maker stand. Amidst all that was different, she found a taste of home, the lowly soft pretzel. It's what she often bought for lunch outside her office building in downtown Philadelphia. Oh, it wasn't identical to the soft pretzel she knew, but it was close enough. It soothed her transition from Pennsylvania to North Dakota. She became a regular customer, on some weeks making daily stops. But along with the food was a bonus. It was the hospitality of the managers, Char and Linda. They were so kind, Kathleen recalled. I remember thinking, this town has really nice people. Did they see a vulnerable, desperately homesick and lonely woman, as Kathleen describes herself at that time? Or was this how they treated every regular customer? Either way, Kathleen remembers these women as defining North Dakota and its residents. Ordinary people, going about their ordinary days, but making extraordinary imprints. To me, it's a reminder that the smallest kindness can leave the longest legacy. And when that kindness is delivered with a soft pretzel, or a cup of coffee, or a hot casserole, it is a key ingredient in the recipe of hospitality that should define our meaning of Vittles in the Vaseline.
Andrea Wincher Collin is editor of North Dakota Horizons magazine, whose mission is to showcase North Dakota's quality of place, abundant resources, and its people. You can learn more at www.ndhorizons.com. Dakota Datebook is next.
You can take Prairie Public's news and entertainment with you wherever you go. Download Prairie Public's free radio app to listen on your iPhone, iPad, or Droid.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 23rd. North Dakota was poised to play a game of chance and change on this date in 1977. Bingo, it's legal in North Dakota, read the lead sentence of the forum in Fargo. As Saturday began at the stroke of 12 a.m., legal charity gambling began for the first time in North Dakota's history. Gambling was certainly not new to the history of government. In 1775, America's earliest days, there was a lottery that raised money for the colonial army. 202 years later, gambling as revenue came to North Dakota. North Dakotans in favor of the legislation argued that gambling could serve as a new method to increase voluntary taxation, as other states had found in the 1960s and 1970s. The inauguration had not come without controversy or concessions. The new gaming laws were limited to public-spirited organizations that included civic, religious, educational, and fraternal groups. These entities could now conduct games of chance that included raffles, tip jars, punch boards, and the aforementioned bingo. No cards or video gaming machines were included. The generated net proceeds for each new enterprise were to be designated for public-spirited charitable causes. The launch of gambling was not without its opposition, even from the highest office in the state. Governor Art Link, no supporter of the bill, had allowed it to become law without his signature. Link announced the day before his decision to let the bill slide into law.
With that news, a mass of would-be licensees headed to Bismarck the Friday before the law would take effect. Elks, eagles, and moose stampeded to the Attorney General's office at the Capitol. 50 eager organizations were granted licenses that day. The first went to Minot VFW Post 753. Flooded with gaming license applicants, Assistant Attorney General Dale Sandstrom's office worked extended hours. The newspaper reported that from then on, Sandstrom was a man on the run. One of his secretaries reported, "I think the phone's grown into his ear today." Sandstrom said his office had relied on the governor's word and was therefore legally secure in issuing the licenses the day before the law took effect. In the past 35 years, the state's gaming has had successes and taken hits, but nothing can quite compare to the excitement at its introduction in 1977. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Stark. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Just enough time left in Main Street to acknowledge the passing of somebody well known to a lot of North Dakotans across the state, especially on the eastern end of the state, where Marv Bossert was the main anchor at WDAY News for over 40 years and taught at Minnesota State University Moorhead in the Mass Comm department for about 40 years as well. He was also a friend and a wonderful colleague. Somebody who set a pretty high standard and certainly lived a very good life and an important one for the people here. We should acknowledge that he graduated from Fargo Central High School. He went to UND in 1952. He worked at the campus radio station there and then KFJM. Of course, now it's part of Prairie Public as a producer, newscaster, and announcer. And he then went on to Northwestern University, to the Medill School of Journalism, where he graduated in the 50s and went on to work at WLS in Chicago for this well-known radio guy by the name of Paul Harvey. Then he came north to Fargo, got into TV, when it was pretty young, and became a very familiar face for people for a long, long time. But the other thing to remember is that he was a teacher, and he was a very good fellow. There will be a gathering for Marv from 5 to 7 at Nativity Catholic Church in Fargo. That's on Friday. There will be a funeral for Marv at 11 o'clock at Nativity Catholic Church on Saturday. Arrangements by Bolger Funeral Home, Marv Bossert, who will be missed by so many friends and colleagues and, of course, his wife Betty and his four daughters. Marv Bossert passed away today at the age of 79. Tomorrow on Main Street, highlights from the recent event where Louise Erdrich was honored with the Rough Rider Award. That's North Dakota's number one award. And we'll also hear from Bill Law, Ashley.
Absolutely. Fewer than 50 universities in all of the U.S. can officially claim status as a school of music. And we'll be talking with Bill Law from NDSU, which is a freshly minted one of them.
And we're going to have fun with physics, because Physics Force is coming to North Dakota. This is a group from the U of M that put on a stage show that has a bit of everything, slapstick and music and, of course, physics. So we're going to learn something tomorrow, as well as have a good time talking to each other. You have a great evening.